Okay. I want to try to, anyone here for the very first time, real quick, on a Wednesday night for the very, very first time? Tell us your name, sir.
Sam Blackwell.
Sam, welcome. Pleasure to have you. Anyone else for the first time on a Wednesday night? Yes.
Tanya.
Tanya, where are you from again?
I'm Russia originally.
From Russia originally. Welcome. You're here Shabbat. Welcome to Wednesday. And your name?
Lauren.
What's that?
Lauren.
And you're from, we've met before, Lauren.
Yeah, I come to your Monday.
Yes, you're a Monday, but you can come Wednesday. You don't need a special visa for Wednesday. Okay, so welcome, guys. Very, very briefly to recap a little from last week and jump into this week. And this was the fellowship. We have some evidence. Pretty solid evidence that there must be some kind of oral transmission of some decoding, let's call it, of the biblical text. Right, because you got all these words and phrases in the Torah, and they're not very specific, and yet Jews for thousands of years seem to be practicing these laws in a very specific kind of way. Who can give me an example? You guys, a lot of you, great homework, by the way, for amongst the... Well, what's an example of something, Abigail? Oh, that's interesting. I didn't give those last week. But the truth is, Pidgin HaBen would be a good example. Bar Mitzvah less so, because there's really very little that you have to do to actually fulfill the bar mitzvah, and it's not really biblically mandated either. But the Pidgin HaBen is the redemption of the firstborn. Yeah?
In the Torah, there's a reference to bind like my words on your head and your arm. That's it.
Bind my words on your head and your arm.
Something like that.
Yeah. Ukishartem la'ot al yadecha. And bind it on your hand. Ulatotafot and atotafot. Between your eyes. What's atotafot? What's a totafot? Phylacteries. And what are phylacteries? I don't know. I mean, you can get really creative, but mostly they look like black leather boxes with parchment rolled up inside. And everybody seems to know that, and I've never seen a red pair of tefillin or a round pair of tefillin, and yet there's nothing in the biblical text other than bind it as a sign upon your own totafot between your eyes. What's another example we give? Not necessarily kashrut, but the laws of, actually before kashrut even. What's that? No, not sukkah. It has to do with your burger that you're eating. Shchita, the laws of ritual slaughter. What does it say? It just says, and you shall slaughter the animal as I've commanded you. You go through the whole five books of Moses, as I've commanded you. You're looking for it. Where is it? I don't know. So what are rabbis studying for months and months? I brought that up last week. I thought they still are. I did. Shuki didn't have to. I don't know. Things are changing. And where is it all? Good. Tzitzis actually is a good example. The third paragraph of the Shema, it says you shall wear these fringes. You ever see a pair of tzitzis? It's got a certain amount of knots, and some of them have a thread of blue, and there's a big debate, because according to some modern-day halachic archaeologists, many believe that they have discovered the snail, thank you, that produces the dye that makes the tzitzit blue, which is why sometimes you'll see on some men's tzitziot, or in the talit, you'll actually see the blue. You know, I never saw that growing up. It's maybe 20 years, 25 years old. But it's the rage today. You can actually go in Israel. What's that? You went?
I did.
It's called the... It's a place in Israel where you can go and see the little snails.
Factory.
What is it? The Tzchelet. The Tzchelet factory. Tzchelet is the blue. Okay, and all of those details of tzitzit are not mentioned in the Torah yet. So where are they mentioned? They were just passed down orally from generation to generation. And of course, they weren't supposed to be written down, but they were written down because of some historical necessity. And what's the body of work that we... The Talmud. The Talmud is really where all this stuff is written down. Yeah, question.
Yeah, so that's actually... You know, the oral tradition, to my understanding, that's taken as law, and we reference something that was written 2,000 years ago, but if it was in fact oral, that's an arbitrary moment of time in terms of which we stopped kind of reinterpreting or figuring it out, or maybe it was always the same. I guess how am I phrasing this question? I know why they wrote it down at the time, we talked about that last week, that makes a lot of sense, but there is... as opposed to continuing on sort of the concept of, well, like, you know, it's oral, we always refer back to this book, as opposed to thinking back to, going back to,
You know what?
I'm having difficulty
it's okay, but,
my question right
but
now.
You've thrown out a whole bunch of things that I'm actually going to be spending tonight on.
I'm trying to
which is the train. Thank you. Which is the chain of transmission, mm-hmm. And does it stop? Meaning, at what point? You know, first
that's
of all,
my question.
Yeah. At what point did it just stop, and now we're just stuck with all these laws? Does it change? Does it evolve? I'm going to discuss that tonight. Also, it's important to remember, again, as a review from last week, without anybody writing anything down or videoing it or taping it and putting it on while you Torah so you can listen to it next week, how did they get it from Moses to the next generation? We discussed this last week. What did Maimonides say? How did this happen? How did Moshe, who had all this information in his head, spend 40 days, 40 nights on Har Sinai, 40 years in the wilderness, getting all this information that was oral to explain the biblical text? How did that get to the next generation? Yeah, David.
Like the repetition.
Good, exactly. Not like the repetition. The repetition. Who was the first person Moses gave it over to?
Aaron.
His brother Aaron. And then his brother Aaron, after he heard the whole explanation. And by the way, this was not done in one sitting. You understand? This took the 40 years of the wilderness. So he gets another piece of information. He sits Aaron down, explains the biblical text. This is what God explained it to mean. Aaron then takes a seat next to him. His two sons come in. Eleazar and Itamar says the same thing. Aaron hears it again. They take a seat. Okay, and then there's the Zakenim, the elders, and then the entire people. And this is what's going on. We were a people of the book and scholarship from the very, very beginning. Now, that doesn't guarantee a perfect transmission. And to be intellectually honest, there were breaks. And there were times when certain things were forgotten. I'm not an expert on that. There are people who have written doctoral theses for their studies in graduate school on different periods of time when things were questioned. And I'm going to get into all the debates that the Talmud has. Let's just take a few more questions. Yeah.
Who were the elders?
The Zakenim were the 70 elders that Moses appointed as the great scholars of his generation. Whose idea was that? His father. In law, who was a Midianite priest, who was supposed to be converting to Judaism, saw Moses standing, or he saw the nation standing, waiting on line after the Torah was given, with questions. And what did he say to Moshe, his son-in-law?
You're stressing yourself out.
You need you need to go to the Bahamas and chill out. No, what did he say?
Delegate.
You got to delegate, and you have to appoint the 70 scholars who understand. And they can answer the questions, and the difficult ones will go to you. Some questions, you even have an episode, what was a special story in the Torah, where a group of women came to Moses with a question. He didn't know the answer, he consulted God himself. And that was in my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, I'm sorry you missed it.
It's on the plate.
In Parshat Pinchas, when the Benot Slavcha, the daughters of Slavcha, they said it's not fair, we're not getting a portion of the land of Israel. Because our father is no longer alive, we have no brothers. Can women inherit a portion of the land of Israel? Moses didn't know the answer. And he went to God, and God said, yes, they have a good claim. Cain benot Slavchad Dovrot, the daughters of Slavchad are answering properly. So there's this whole experience going on in the wilderness. And the 70 elders become what, subsequently? Because in every generation, there's always a 70 elders. Who are they? What are they eventually called? They end up becoming the Beitin HaGadol, the great court, what's called in Hebrew the
Sanhedrin.
Has anyone here heard of the Sanhedrin? Okay, the Sanhedrin was the Jewish Supreme Court, if you will. And they were appointed by Moses in his generation, and anyone who was a member of the Sanhedrin had what's called smicha, ordination from someone who got smicha, from someone who got smicha, from someone who got smicha from Moshe himself. That's what it meant back then to get smicha, ordination. When a rabbi gets ordained today, it's very nice. I have a klaf in my office, like a piece of parchment that says I'm a quote-unquote expert in this area, in that area, but it's not a real smicha. A real smicha means that my rabbi and teacher got it from a rabbi and teacher who can say that he got it from Moses himself. And we had that unbroken chain of transmission for centuries. I'd like if you can join with me on page 7 of your handout. Take a look on page 7. Yeah, what's that? Oh, there's so many examples. By the way, Every one of the 613 commandments is an example, basically, because they're not all spelled out in the five books. Okay? By the way, before I go through this train of tradition, can anyone tell me, therefore, why is there so much debate in the Talmud? If this was just given over from God to Moses at Sinai, and it was just passed down from generation to generation, then why all the debate? You can't go 5-6 lines on any page on any Talmud without a debate. Two Jews, three opinions. What's that? So you have to understand that there were five parts of the oral tradition, and I don't want to get you bogged down, and I might spend a few minutes later if we have time. One of the five parts were verses and phrases that were left unexplained by God to the Jewish people, and God then gave these 70 elders a certain principles, what we call in Hebrew, well, I'm going to say them in English, the 13, here's another helpful English translation, the 13 hermeneutical principles, the 13 principles, has anyone ever heard of this? Through which the sages were to derive halakha from the biblical text. And I'll give you an example in a minute. So what's a methodology? There's something called kal vachomer. Can I borrow this? So let's say this weighs 5 pounds, and my little recorder weighs 1 pound. Okay, so this is kal, and this is chomer. This is light, and this is heavy. If Wilds can lift the bottle, which is weighing 5 pounds, then kal vachomer, Wilds can lift the lighter item. Okay, and there are 13 of these different types of logical hermeneutical principles that were given over to this body of sages to use to interpret the biblical text when the biblical text did not have a tradition. When we didn't have that passed down halacha l'Moshe Mitzrayim, the tefillin is supposed to be black, the tzitzis is supposed to be wrapped up like this, the Shabbat candles are lit like this. Whenever you had gaps and you had verses, the rabbis are supposed to use these 13. Now, you and I can use them, but it's only the Supreme Court's interpretation that ultimately becomes followed, because they represent the entire people. And I'll come back to that soon. I'll give you a little example. I just went to a wedding. How does a couple get married? Jewish couple, husband and wife. How do they become a married couple? A ketubah? Good suggestion. Is Abigail right? What's a ketubah? Rabbis invented the ketubah to make sure that in the event of a divorce, the husband would still support his wife. Because the Bible doesn't allow for it. That's called rabbinic. And we're going to talk about rabbinic law. I'm not even discussing rabbinic law. Everything I'm talking about is biblical now. How do they get married then? From the Torah. And I'm glad you said the ketubah. A lot of people think, how do they get... Well, a dowry might be something the woman would bring into the wedding.
The ring.
Good. The man gives something of value over to the woman. Doesn't even have to be a ring, but we use a ring. And that's why it should be easily ascertainable. That's why the ring that the husband and wife get married with should not be ornate or with etchings, right, or diamonds on it. Very simple, easily ascertainable to its value. The man gives something of value to the woman. Remember this, guys? Not so long ago. Okay? The woman receives it. She has to willingly receive it. It can't, like, throw the ring and go, I gotcha! Rest of our lives together. And it has to be witnessed. Where does that come from? What does it say in the Torah about when a man wants to marry a woman? It says, Ki yikach ish isha. That's it. When a man takes a woman. Take, by the way, is the language of wedding, of betrothal. The Talmud, so the rabbis use one of the 13 hermeneutical principles. They look for the word take elsewhere in the Torah. It's called the Gezer Shava. It's not the Kal Vachomer like I just did before. It's another one of the 13 hermeneutical principles. They realize that they see the way the word is used elsewhere, and they apply what that word means elsewhere to that context. And that's how we get to this day, how a husband marries his wife, or how a wife is married, or how a Jewish couple becomes a couple. Now, you want to do whatever you want under the chuppah, that's great. A lot of people say, I prefer to do it this way. I always say, you know, if you ever any lawyers in the room or people in real estate, it's like you want to buy a piece of property, and then the lawyer comes along and says, you need to sign this, you need to do that, you need to jump through these hoops. Everybody listens. Because they want to own the home, and they don't want to have any problems later. But when it comes to a wedding, I'll do it this way. The rabbi says they should do it that way, but that's just his preference. Here's my preference. No, there's actually a way that we believe metaphysically a husband and wife are actually married to each other through this legal process called kiddushin, which means sanctification, giving over something of value. How did we derive that? That's what's important for our discussion. Was it a rabbinic thing? No. It was the rabbis. And who are the rabbis? When I say the rabbis now, I'm not talking about me or even Rabbi Ezra downtown or Rabbi Jonathan Eastside or Rabbi Shuki. We're talking about the sages who were the members of the 70 group. And when did that 70 group start? Who was the first? Who appointed the first 70 group?
Moshe.
Moses himself. There was a 70 group in every generation until, anybody know when? The destruction of the second temple. Do you know where the 70 group sat? Where was the seat of the Jewish Supreme Court? It sat in the temple. And when the temple was destroyed, the Sanhedrin was disbanded. And we haven't had a Sanhedrin since the second temple essentially was destroyed. And the Romans basically enslaved our people, brought a whole bunch back to Italy, elsewhere in the world. And Jewish law definitely changed as a result. Because until that point, you had sages who could actually enact laws. Those sages were authorized to create laws. What do you call a law that one of the great sages enacted that was ultimately accepted by the people? That's called a rabbinic law. What do you call a law that was derived from the biblical text by the sages? That's called a biblical law. That's not called a rabbinic law. A lot of people get this confused. Just because the rabbis are the ones deriving it, where are they getting it from? They're getting it from the biblical text. They're not making it up. You're saying, well, they're using their interpretation. Yes, they are. No different than the United States Supreme Court. Because you and I can look at the Constitution, and Mariana, your interpretation of a clause in the Constitution could be this, and my interpretation, and we can have a really nice scholarly debate. But guess what? I can't go to jail for not following your interpretation, and you can't go to jail or be fined for not following my interpretation. Why? Because I should speak for myself, but we're nobodies. We are not members of the Supreme Court. So even if I was Alan Dershowitz and I was a great Harvard legal scholar, it wouldn't really matter what Dershowitz's interpretation was unless he was a member of the Supreme Court, and he could, and his interpretation then becomes a binding interpretation of the text, in that case the Constitution. The major difference between the Constitution and Torah law is, what would you say the major difference?
Origin.
Well, the origin, okay? And therefore, and that actually explains the difference I was looking for. That's true. What's that?
Seems that's not necessarily true because a lot of modern day law comes from...
Okay, yeah. I mean, a lot of laws and even clauses in the Constitution are all ultimately a reflection of a biblical Judeo-Christian ethic. So you could say indirectly, God was behind some of the constitutions too. That's true. But what's the major practical difference? Today, if you're upset with something in the Constitution or something in American law, let's hear it from a lawyer. You can amend it. You can change it through the legislative process. We don't do that, at least in the more traditional Jewish world. We don't believe, I don't believe, that we have that authority and that power. Now it's interesting. What about a rabbinic law? Why can't a rabbi today in 2017 amend a rabbinic law? I wouldn't play with a biblical law. I won't even play with a biblical law through which the sages derived it, because its source is the Bible from God. But what about a rabbinic law? What about like the ketubah? I don't like the language of the ketubah. It seems very archaic. I said this at the wedding actually. I went on an archaeological dig with my kids a couple of years ago, and they in a Maccabean cave, and they actually found a ketubah. Not the whole ketubah, that carbon dated over 2,000 years old, exact language we use in our ketubahs. Now, if you go to the Judaica shop, and you walk in, and you say, what kind of ketubah would you like? Would you like vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, reform, conservative, or, like, you can take your pick. So what's the craziness with sticking to an old text? Or the same thing with our prayers. You have to tell me how to pray? I got to read some words that some rabbi 2,000 years ago wrote? Let me bring it up to date. Come on, let's get with the game. Or some rule and law that doesn't seem to make sense anymore? What is the reason why... I'm not arguing on the biblical level because that's from God, but these were people. So who is the Sanhedrin and why does it matter? And this is a very, very important idea. And by the way, there's a lot riding on this issue. It's a very, very sensitive issue. And that has to do, and I'll ask any of the lawyers in the room, if you would like to change a law, let's say that was established by some court, whether on the federal or state level, what do you need to do even here?
Petition.
Well, you have to petition, right? And you need at least the same stature, right? If you want to appeal, right, you have to go to a higher court. A court of appeals, for example, is a higher court than, let's say, the district, on the district level. In halacha, it's actually less. All you need is the same level. And here's the problem. And we're going to talk about this for the next couple of weeks. It's going to come up with the examples. Next week, Siamese twins, cosmetic surgery, and all this stuff. Practical things you need, according to Jewish tradition, in order even to amend a rabbinic law, you need a rabbinic body at least the same stature of the rabbinic body that promulgated it back then. And you can't get that without a Sanhedrin, because who were they? Who were they? They were members of Sanhedrin. They were individuals who could trace their ordination to Moses himself. They were part of the Supreme Court, and they represented the people. Now, some people say, if we can get 70 rabbis together today, let's make a Sanhedrin today. Why can't we make a Sanhedrin? A lot of people think it's linked in with the temple and the Messiah, and you can't just put 70 rabbis in Reuben and say you're the Sanhedrin. That's meaningless. Others say no, that you could actually, according to some opinions, when I say opinions, I don't mean Rabbi Mi or Rabbi Shuka, I mean like rabbinic opinion, sages, that you could do that if you got the unanimous consensus of that generation, which is what the Sanhedrin ultimately represents. That's where they derive their power, from the people and, of course, from their connection to Moses and Sinai and so on and so forth. And there are so many distinctions about this. For example, I mean, okay, I'm not going to give examples. I want to jump through this. Take a look on page 7. Any questions just about any of this? Yeah, Casey.
I want to make sure I understand rabbinic law. These are things...
Who can give me an example of rabbinic law? I gave the ketubah as an example. They fill in gaps. The rabbi saw that a man divorces his wife when women were not in the workforce and they were out of their father's homes. They really didn't have a means of support. So the rabbis ordained, they said, you're not allowed to be married without a ketubah. And what is the ketubah? It's not a contract, actually. It's a statement of obligations of the husband to the wife in the event of divorce. It is the least romantic thing you'll ever read in your life. The fact that we post them on our walls, we pay a lot of money, it's kind of like a little, I don't know what it is, somebody got away with making some money off ketubahs, because they're really very there's one line that's very beautiful, I always say that, says that, I'll give you even the shirt off my back. It's very, very beautiful. The man pledges his allegiance. That's why Jewish husbands always, the Jews always make good husbands, you know, because they were obligated, according to Torah law, to support their wives. By the way, it also says in there that that the husband has to also clothe her, feed her, and satisfy her. And I talked about this in my class on sexuality. Satisfy means sexual gratification. Actually, it's in the ketubah. Okay, and it's the obligations of a man to his wife. Now, so what about the obligations to the woman, to the man? There's a line in there. There's one little line that says, and a woman... What's that?
That's not how this works.
Well, it doesn't work that way because the rabbis were concerned that basically a woman would be out on... is the oldest protection of women's rights, actually, that ever existed, the ketubah. So what's another example of rabbinic law?
Mixing milk and meat. So
mixing milk... What aspect?
So, like, is it going to be beef, chicken, what is meat?
Chicken is a good example. The Torah says, "Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo." Do not mix the kid in its mother's milk. You're not allowed to mix meat and milk. The rabbis came along and said, "Does that include? Is that red meat? Does that include chicken?
Right.
What?
Red meat.
Biblically. Only red meat. Yeah. Gedi is a kid.
Yeah.
A kid, not a kid, but a kid. You know, and that is talking about red meat." So where did chicken? Why can't I have chicken with Parmesan? What is it? So the rabbis came along just to make your life more difficult. This is their job. Why did the rabbis do this? Who knows? And by the way, every rabbinic law must have a reason. You don't just do it, just do it. No, we have laws in the Torah like that because we don't pretend to understand God. But we should be able to understand the great sages and what they were thinking.
Added protection.
Against what?
Well, if you have meat, then
So chicken and red meat were always kind of served together. You go into a meat restaurant, they've got chicken. And the concern was, is if you get too used to having chicken and milk, you might come to... Yeah. It's the slippery slope. There's a lot of slippery slope kind of laws in the Torah. By the way, Shabbat, when we get to Shabbat, you'll see a lot of slippery slope things. You know, biblically, you can't do da-da-da, but rabbinically, there's a whole bunch of other things because we're concerned. So my favorite example, and I'll come back to it. So on Shabbat, one of the 39... forbidden labors is to write. Okay, but I just walk around with a pen. I'm not going to write with it. I might want to spit, during the service. I'm bored. I don't know. I want to do something else with it. I'm sorry. I put your pen in my mouth. So what is this? Why can't I carry this around? The rabbis forbade us to actually carry something that is used usually for one of the 39 acts of work that are forbidden. It's called muktzah. And it's basically a preventative measure. Where did the rabbis derive the authority to do this? A verse in the Torah, the book of Leviticus, that says you should listen to the sages of your generation. They were authorized to enact laws, not to make our lives more difficult, but to make sure that the laws, of the Torah itself are not violated. That's the negative ones. The rabbis also enacted positive laws, like the ketubah's one, or like lighting candles, having Shabbat, having three meals, eating two loaves of bread, singing songs, going on a walk. I mean, virtually, I would say 80, 90% of what most of us do to celebrate the Sabbath is rabbinic in nature. The rabbis helped create, the only thing biblical positively to do on Shabbat is Kiddush and Havdalah. There's a biblical source for that. Zachor Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. Remember the Sabbath and Shamar Yom HaShabbat, guard the Sabbath from being violated, 39 acts of work. Much else we do is rabbinic. And they create the richness. So when you go to a wedding also, if the man gives the woman a ring, is that a biblical or rabbinic? Let's see if you're listening. Don't answer, let's get somebody else. The man gives the woman a ring to marry her, has he just performed a biblical mitzvah or rabbinic?
Biblical.
The woman's walking around the man seven times. That's not even rabbinic law. That's what's called a custom. There's a difference between a minhag and a law. Okay, and that's why the rabbi who's performing the ceremony often has a little leeway when it comes to minhagim, customs, because those vary according to the community also. Sparta custom, even a Moroccan custom might be different than a Persian custom. They like to call up the Kohen and give a blessing. Maybe say a Shechianu. The Ashkenazim don't do that. That's where you get into all these types of things. The only part where you see debate in the Talmud, going back to biblical now, so where's all the debate in the Talmud? It's not all the laws passed down from generation to generation. The tefillin are black, the tzitzis are rolled like this. It's those verses that didn't have a tradition, that were left up to the sages of the Sanhedrin to interpret, to arrive at Torah law. There's the big debate on that. This rabbi says we use the kal v'chomer, the light and the heavy. And this rabbi says, no, we should use the gzera shava. We found this word over here. And they apply it differently because different minds think differently. So how do you know what to do in those situations if they're arguing? What do we do? What's a Jewish principle when people argue?
Majority
rules. Acharei rabin lahatos. It's a verse from the Torah. The entire Western legal system got that concept of majority from the Bible. Says Acharei Rabbi Mahatos. And that's what we do. We basically follow the majority opinion in the Talmud, and then it gets bottom lined, and that's what the community does. That's what you see happening when you go to someone's house on Shabbat, and you see it was actually a subject of a debate in the Talmud, but there's a bottom line. We actually follow what most of the rabbis believe is the way that it should be followed. Question in the back. Moses to Joshua. The first smicha that was ever given was Moshe to Yehoshua. and he gave him smicha. The word smicha means to lean. I want to share something about that in a little about all these rabbinic tradition. But that was the first one. Last question, and I want to move on.
So is the Jewish, modern Jewish prenup kind of...
I wouldn't put that in the sage thing. What happened was we have a modern issue. I think it existed for a long time, but it got bigger, which was called the recalcitrant husband. It's the euphemism for the jerk. Because according to the Torah, in order for a husband and wife to be divorced, the man must give the get, the woman must receive it. I've been in situations where the woman refuses to receive it, and it doesn't go through either. Okay? And what is it? But it's more often where the man, out of spite, or his lawyer tells him to hold out for a larger settlement, and says, I'm not going to give you the get unless da-da-da. And that's not the way a get was supposed to be. Two people decide to divorce, you give a get. And that's what the prenup is. It's probably about 30 years old. It's pretty new. I won't do any weddings without it. None of the MGE rabbis are allowed to do weddings. I created that MGE decree here. And I said that, which means that before you get married, you sign something that's notarized that says that in the event of a separation leading to divorce, the man will not withhold a get, and the woman will not withhold receiving it. And if either of them do, there is a penalty that the secular court can impose. We put in like $200, depending on how much money they have, $200, $250 a day, they can freeze their assets. And it actually works, it's got teeth, and it prevents this whole terrible phenomenon, what's called a guna of a chained woman. A woman who's stuck because her husband won't give her a get. Unfortunately, a lot of people get married without it, and it should. And you shouldn't get married without it. It needs to become mainstream. Like, we need to get to a day where nobody in the Jewish community gets married without it. Period.
So it's not mainstream.
It's very mainstream in the modern Orthodox community. It's very mainstream. Very few rabbis I know will marry people without it. Okay, take a look on page 7, and I want to read a couple of stories. It's not considered halakhically a wedding, a marriage. So it's a relationship, obviously, but it's not viewed as a marriage, so therefore they're never married, therefore they don't need to be halakhically divorced. Page 7 is the chain of tradition. I'm not going to run through it with you, but I want you to have a little sense. Take a look at the top. And Moses, Joshua, the elders, the prophets. I pointed to this last week. This goes all the way down. And I want you to read now with me on page 8 something really, really fascinating. Okay. Page 8 is a debate in the Talmud. And I want to talk a little more about the human, because I think, Casey, you were touching on this, which is, what's our role in this whole process? Okay, it sounds very interesting and complicated, but what is our role today? You know, when we study Torah, we've gathered here tonight, are we just sort of recollecting what was, and we've got this body of laws, we just have to follow them robotically? Or does our learning somehow part of the process of the chain of transmission? You know where I'm going with this. Of course it is. It doesn't end. It does end if you stop learning and you stop teaching. Follow with me on the top of the page. Very famous passage from the Talmud. Rabbi Elazar ruled, I'm just going to fly, I'm sorry, I just love to cover, that a certain object was ritually pure, and the sages ruled it was ritually impure. There's a debate, lots of debate in the Talmud. One rabbi says, this item is ritually impure. The other rabbis said it's ritually impure. Now what happens when Rabbi Elazar says A, and the Chachamim, a group of rabbis, say B? Who do you follow?
The majority
follow the group. On that day, Rabbi Elazar offered every imaginable argument to support his ruling, but they did not accept him. He said to them, if the halacha is in accordance with my view, then let this carob tree serve as proof. Thereupon, the carob tree was uprooted and moved 100 cubits. Rabbi Elazar saw he was beaten, because the majority of rabbis disagreed with him. He said, but I'm right. I don't care that there's so many of you, and I'll prove to you that I'm right. What am I going to... If this carob tree somehow becomes uprooted and it moves, then you know I'm right. And it did. What do the rabbis say? The sages answered, no proof can be derived from a carob tree. He then said, let the stream of water prove that the halacha is in accordance with my opinion. Whereupon the stream began to flow backwards. Wow. The sages said, what's that?
Since one of these rabbis so superstitious?
Well, I don't believe they're superstitious. The question is, did they have spiritual, I don't want to call them magical, but did they have powers to affect the natural world? We see many instances where they did. These were not, that's why when I say the rabbis, no offense to me and my colleagues, okay, but we're not talking about Rabbi Joe Schmo from Long Island. We're talking about the great sages who have this direct line of transmission from Moses. The sages said no proof can be derived from a stream. He then said, let the walls of the study hall serve as proof. And the walls of the study hall buckled, about to fall. But Rabbi Yeshua rebuked them and said, what right do you have to intervene when sages argue about halacha? So the walls did not fall in deference to Rabbi Yeshua, but they did not straighten up out of respect for Rabbi Eliezer. Whereupon Rabbi Eliezer said, let the heavens prove that I'm right, that the halacha is in accordance with my opinion. And a bat kol, a voice rang out from the heavens and said, why do you argue with my son Eliezer? God gets involved in this dispute and puts it to end, you would think. But what do the sages say? Rabbi Yeshua stood up and declared, Lo bashamayim hi. Very famous. I'm telling it to you in the Hebrew. The Torah is not in the heavens. He turned to God and he said, stay out of this. We're here to figure out the way we're supposed to serve you, and we're going to figure it out. What did he mean? Rabbi Yirmiyahu said, once the Torah was given at Sinai, we pay no heed to heavenly voices. For it says in the Torah, you shall follow the majority. And the majority in this case differed with Rabbi Eliezer. Rav Natan later met the prophet Eliyahu. Anybody knows about the prophet Eliyahu? He never seemed to die. His spirit always somehow lingered. Eliyahu HaNavi, there's a song we sing about him on Saturday night as Shabbat ebbs away. Thank you, Tom. Rav Natan later met the prophet Eliyahu and asked him, what did God do when Rabbi Yeshua made the statement? When Rabbi Yeshua turned to God and say, Lo bashamayim hi, the halacha is not in the heavens. Stay out of this, God. What was God's reaction? They want to know from Elijah the prophet. Probably, what did he say? God smiled and said, my sons have defeated me. What's happening here? This is very important. And to follow with me from a book, if you want to get a book about the written and the oral Torah, Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardoza, he used to speak here. He doesn't come as often. He lives in Israel. He's a great scholar. He's of Dutch descent, and he sounds it. And he's wrote an amazing book called The Written Oral Torah. And he says, once the Torah was given at Sinai, God wanted man to interpret it without paying attention to supernatural intervention. To be sure, there are rules governing this interpretation. We talked about those rules. 13 hermeneutical principles, stuff passed down. You and I can interpret, but that doesn't become a binding interpretation unless you remember the Sanhedrin, right? But as long as you explain the Torah in a manner consistent with these axioms, he can determine the law with complete confidence that his rulings are acceptable. In a sense, God has limited his right to intervene in the halachic process. He prefers orderly legal procedures to miracles and heavenly voices. Were supernatural phenomena allowed to influence the decision of halacha, the entire structure of Torah study, the pillar upon which all of Judaism rests, would collapse. Remove the sages' ability to interpret the law, you render the debates and dialogues of the Talmud meaningless. The sages' right to determine the halacha must be independent of divine negation if Judaism is to be an ever-fresh and dynamic way of life. The episode recounted was a test. Had the sages agreed to accept Rabbi Eliezer's opinion, right, the one who kept bringing all of these supernatural proofs, because of the voice from heaven, they would have misunderstood the basis of the revelation, that even though the Torah comes from God, it was ultimately given over to us. The Torah is not in heaven. Everything man needs to know concerning the Torah was given to him at Sinai. It is our responsibility to use this knowledge and these tools to develop the system of living that living the Torah ultimately demands. And this is very, very important, because we think that it's a lot of hocus pocus. It's really not. We do have a lot of ideas passed down, but we're supposed to use our own minds. We're supposed to figure out what we're doing when we're learning. And there's really almost a symphony of generations when you study Torah, because time begins to lose its meaning. And I want to read you something that I heard, actually, a tape of. You can actually get this tape. And this was a speech that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave many, many years ago. And I want to read it to you. It's just a little excerpt to explain a little the emotion of studying Torah in modern times. And that when you study Torah, you're not merely trying to memorize information from years past. You're trying to analyze it for yourself to make it relevant and meaningful for you and figure out what to do for yourself. But of course, there are rules and laws. Okay? The old Rebbe, he says, walks into the classroom crowded with students who are young enough to be his grandchildren. Now, the Rav said this when he was very old. He enters as an old man with a wrinkled face, his eyes reflecting the fatigue and sadness of old age. The Rebbe is seated and sees before him rows of young, beaming faces, clear eyes radiating the joy of being young. For a moment, the Rebbe is gripped with pessimism. With tremors of uncertainty, he asks himself, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and young students, between a Rebbe in his Indian summer and students enjoying the spring of their lives? The Rebbe starts the class, uncertain as to how it will proceed. Suddenly, the door opens, and an old man, much older than the Rebbe, answers. He is the grandfather of the Rebbe, Reb Chaim Brisker, who lived from 1853 to 1918. He's talking about his grandfather. It would be most difficult to study Talmud with students who are trained in the sciences and mathematics, were it not for his method, which is very modern and equals, if not surpasses, most contemporary forms of logic, metaphysics, or philosophy. The door opens again, and another old man comes in. He's older than Reb Chaim, because he lived in the 17th century. His name is Reb Shabtai Cohen, lived in 1622 to 1663, known as the Shach, who must be present when civil law, Dine Mamonos, are discussed. Many more visitors arrive, some from the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, others harking back to antiquity, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, the Rambam, Maimonides, the Ravid, the Rashba, Rabbi Akiva, and others. These scholarly giants of the past are bidden to take their seats. The Rebbe introduces the guests to his pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam states a halacha. The Ravid sharply disagrees, as is his wont. Some students interrupt to defend the Rambam, and they express themselves harshly against the Ravid, as young people are apt to do. The Rebbe softly corrects the students, suggests more restrained tones. The Rashba smiles gently. The Rebbe tries to analyze what the students meant, and the other students intercede. Rabbeinu Tam is called upon to express his opinion, and suddenly a symposium of generations comes into existence. Young students debate earlier generations with an air of daring familiarity, and a crescendo of discussion ensues. All speak one language, all pursue one goal, all are committed to a common vision, and all operate within the same categories. A masora, collegiality, is achieved. Masora means tradition. A friendship, a comradeship of young and old, spanning antiquity, the Middle Ages, modern times, the joining of generation, the merger of identities will ultimately bring about the redemption of the Jewish people, that will fulfill the words of the last of the Hebrew prophets, Malachi, quote, "And Elijah shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers." The messianic realization will witness the great dialogue of the generations. About 2 or 3 hours later, the Rebbe emerges from the chamber, young and rejuvenated. He has defeated age. The students look exhausted. In the Masorah experience, years play no role. Hands, however parchment dry and wrinkled, embrace warm and supple hands in a commonality bridging the gap which separates the generations. Thus the old ones of the past continue their great dialogue of the generations, ensuring an enduring commitment to the Masorah, the Hu HaKetz. This is the secret that will lead to the Messianic redemption. What is the Rav really saying here, Rabbi Soloveitchik? What is he trying to capture when you teach a class? When you go to a Torah class and you read a verse from the Torah and you don't know what it means. So then you bring in the oral understanding, and now we're beginning to understand what that means. Where did that come from? And even the oral understanding isn't so clear if you don't have Rashi and the Ramban and the Ravid and the Rabbeinu Tam. And they often argue each other as to even how to understand that oral interpretation of the biblical text. So therefore you need later rabbis to explain those earlier rabbis' interpretation of the interpretation. And you're doing the same thing. And as you enter into that great dialogue and into that debate, you become part of the process of the transmission of the oral tradition and ultimately of Judaism into the next generation. And it's not just new technology and innovation. We were discussing this at our Shabbat table. It's not just new stuff that needs to be figured out. It's even figuring out the old stuff in a new way. Because people think differently in every generation. And if you look at one very last story I want to share with you on page 9, we're going to end with this. It's another passage from the Talmud. I know I'm throwing a lot of passages from the Talmud, but I want to give you a little sense. It's page 9 on the bottom. That's how Torah develops and changes. And I put that word changes in quotes because it really remains the same, but it changes. And it's difficult for me to articulate. It develops. It becomes more sophisticated. In every generation, there's another scholar who looks at that information in a different way, and you come up with a new insight, a new idea. But it's not like we're changing the laws that God gave to Moses at Sinai. And this story will illustrate that again. Look at page 9 on the bottom. Rabbi Yehuda, you guys with me? Mm-hmm. Rabbi Yehuda, in the name of Rab, said, when Moses ascended on high, he found the Holy One, blessed is He, engaged in affixing coronets to the letters. Anybody know what that's talking about? Moshe was on Har Sinai. He sees God Himself affixing coronets to the letters. Has anybody seen a coronet on a Hebrew letter? If you ever open up a Torah scroll, you'll see the beautiful calligraphy that's written there. Some of the letters have little schmitchiks. That's the only way I know how to describe them. Little,
like a crown.
They look like crowns. They look like little crowns on different letters. And when Moshe saw God affixing these crowns to the letters, Moshe said, Lord of the universe, who stays thy hand? And God answers, there will arise a man at the end of many generations, Akiva ben Yosef by name, who will expound upon each tittle heaps of laws. God says that, Moshe, you're not going to live to see this guy, but there's going to be a guy who's so erudite and scholarly, he's going to be able to derive halacha, not just from the words. Remember we said that there are certain phrases and sentences in the Torah that we don't have a tradition for, an oral transmission to explain. So we have the 13 hermeneutical principles, the great six. So he says there's going to be one rabbi who's so erudite, that he's going to be able to derive law from the crowns on top of the letters. And who is this? Rabbi Akiva. Rosha was like, well, I got to meet this guy. Well, he's not going to live for another 1,000 years. But that's not a big deal if you're talking to God. That's why I named my class the Jewish Time Machine tonight. This is where it comes from. So he says, Lord of the universe, said Moses, permit me to see him. He replied, turn thee around. Moshe went and sat down behind 8 rows and listened to the discourses of the law upon the law. He went and sat in the back of Rabbi Akiva's classroom 1,000 years later. Rabbi Akiva lived during the Roman era. Most of us are familiar with Rabbi Akiva because he was the Jew who was an illiterate peasant shepherd who fell in love with a woman, a very aristocratic woman, and the father wouldn't let his daughter marry Akiva because he didn't know anything, couldn't read Hebrew. And he went and studied and became this Rabbi Akiva at the age of 40. Okay. And he replied, turn thee around. Moses went and sat. This is after Rabbi Akiva was a great scholar and had many followers already. And Moshe's sitting in the back of the classroom. He's listening to the class. It's kind of an interesting scene. And then it says, not being able to follow their arguments, he was ill at ease. But when they came to a certain subject, and the disciples said to the master, from where do you know it? That's the most important question every student asks his teacher. Where'd you get that from? What's the source? You just make that up? Where is that? That's what the whole Talmud is. Sources. And they debate. No, it's from here. It's from there. And I'll prove it to you. And the latter said, it's a law given unto Moses at Sinai. He was comforted. Thereupon he returned to the Holy One and said, God, thou hast such a man, and thou givest the Torah by me? And he replied, be silent, for such is my decree. It's a very strange story. First of all, Moshe's sitting in the back of the class. He's not following what's going on. So first of all, what's the deal with that?
Where's the story from?
This is the Talmud in the Tractate Above Metzia, page 59b. The Tractate Above Metzia deals primarily with lost articles. What do you do when you find somebody's... I studied this in sixth grade. It was the first Gemara that they usually teach kids in elementary school. Not that it's easy, but it's usually it's about lost property and returning lost property. But as you know, when you study Talmud, there are stories strewn all over. It's like listening to a scholarly conversation. The rabbis a lot of ADD. They just sort of got off tangent, and those off tangents are these stories. And Moshe doesn't understand what's going on, and he's upset. And then, when one of the students challenges Rabbi Akiva, the teacher, and says, "Where'd you get that from? How do you know that?" And Rabbi Akiva says, "Oh, it's halacha leMoshe miSinai. It's one of those laws transmitted orally from Moses to Sinai." Moshe felt better. Now, what is that? It's like an ego problem Moses has. He's upset because that's kind of embarrassing. He's the one through whom the Torah was given, and he can't understand the class. Why can't he understand the class? Why is it until he hears halacha leMoshe miSinai, it's a law given over Moses at Sinai, he's upset? Why can't he? It's in Aramaic? He doesn't understand the language? They did speak Aramaic, that's true.
He skipped interpretations to get
there. 1,000 years have transpired. Moses is a human being. He was elevated to a very high spiritual level, but he's still, we don't, you know, worship Moshe like, God forbid, he was some god. He's a person. You can't expect him to understand a class that was given 1,000 years later. What happened in those 1,000 years? You think the Torah stayed the same? It developed. It didn't change. How do you know it didn't change? Because when they asked Rabbi Akiva for the source, what did he answer? Halacha leMoshe miSinai. It's the same stuff, but it's developed. You see the difference? We don't change the Torah because we believe its values are eternal and they're from the Almighty. And who are we to change that?
Tree of life.
But Hashem wants, it's a tree of life, thank you. But Hashem wants us to analyze it, to be involved in it, and once He gave it to us, He doesn't stay, He's like, it's yours now. He might try to get involved in the arguments, but what we say, Lobo Shemayim, I'm sorry Hashem, you gave us everything we need to figure it out. And you can ask any question in the world, the Torah has an answer to it. It may not be obvious, and it may be a subject of a debate, but any question that might arise. And we were talking about cloning on Shabbat. We were talking about artificial insemination and fertility technology. Next week we're going to talk about the case of the Siamese twins and whether or not it's permitted to take one life to save another. If both lives are going to die anyway, if they don't do something, I would just shoot from the hip and say, logically, of course I'm going to do it. But you're taking another life. How do you know what to do? Every single thing in life is a decision. I find something on the street. Do I have to return it? Do I have to go run back and find the guy? And it's got no sign on it. He probably gave up hope. Did he not give up hope? These are all principles from the Torah that we are supposed to grapple with, study, analyze, become masters of. And in doing so, bring a great light of wisdom to the world and to our own personal lives. And so it's going to develop. It's going to sound different. And it's going to be more sophisticated and developed as the years pass if we continue to study. But it's still going to be the laws of Moses as given at Sinai. It's still going to be halacha leMoshe miSinai. And the day when we start changing that is the day when we start creating a new religion, a different religion. And then we have really no way to know whether or not this is from God. At the end of the day, we want to know that what we're studying and the way we're analyzing things. And Rav Soloveitchik used to say, I'm going to end in a second, you would never walk into a laboratory if you were a physicist and offer some theorem. If you didn't follow the methodology that the great physicists of the world follow when offering a new theory, if you're a mathematician, if you're a scientist, even if in the social sciences, like in the soft sciences, the humanities, there's a way, there's a scholarly way to present ideas. And as a result, now, we want to present ideas, we want to present new insights, but they have to be done within the way that, like any science, like any discipline, it would be presented, which of course requires us to study and to understand and to say, well, I think this. And somehow that happens in the world of religion. The world of religion, we kind of feel like it's up for grabs. It's for anyone if they want to do. You can just decide what you want to do all of a sudden. But when it comes to law, when it comes to science, no. You need a PhD from an Ivy League school. And even then, you need to process things in a certain way and articulate them in a certain way. And they have to pass muster by the FDA. And there has to be a whole system. Judaism is no different. Judaism is no different. It has a very sophisticated structure. And all of us are invited to participate in it. We just have to learn. And we are pushed and encouraged to become Torah scholars, all of us, not just the rabbis. Rabbis were never supposed to simply be. I have friends who are much more scholarly and learned and knowledgeable than I am, and they're not rabbis. They just happen to have spent many years studying Talmud, and they try whenever they can, they're lawyers, doctors, accountants, whatever they are. And that's the way we're supposed to be as a nation, as a people. And that's what this whole discussion is about. And that's why Rabbi Akiva, in his classroom, Moshe didn't quite understand, but he was comforted because he realized that what they were doing, they were continuing the process of revealing God's wisdom to the world. And that is a very, very beautiful and not such a simple thing to do, and something we're all trying to do ourselves by learning and by getting more involved. Question, yeah, I'm done.
I was just wondering, because you had said, like, when we start changing things from the Torah that was given to us, is when things start to get dangerous. So I had, like, once read something that I guess people were concerned about the reform movement, Reconstructionist movement, but that's exactly what they're doing, that they're sort of, they're changing the way in which the Torah was written,
right.
And they're scared that that's sort of changing the way that Judaism is being portrayed to people who follow it, and for generations to come. Do you feel that that's sort of what's going on? Or
so the reform,
is that what they're doing?
Just on one foot, reform ideology looks at Judaism completely, radically different.
Right.
It was purposely trying to reform Judaism, to change it. They were not trying to hide that. They were trying to say that Judaism needs to be changed if it's going to remain relevant in the modern era. And they do not look at the mitzvot as a binding system of laws and rules for that which we're supposed to follow in our lives. They're basically expressions of ideas. And it's really up to you if you would like to embrace that idea or not. They have a very different view. The conservative view is very different than that. Conservative Judaism believes in the binding nature of mitzvot.
Right.
But their difference with orthodoxy revolves more around rabbinic tradition. Can you change a law, a rabbinic law? And orthodoxy continues to teach, I think, what has been the Talmudic tradition, that unless you have a Beit Din, a Jewish court of the same stature that created the law, you don't have the legal authority to change it. The conservative rabbinate disagreed with that and believed that you could change rabbinic laws. What's happened in the conservative community is that biblical laws also have been changed in the process, because it is a slippery slope. They never intended for that to happen necessarily, but then in effect that's what's happened. And so even within the conservative world, Judaism is starting to look quite different. But the Reform movement never pretended to view Judaism in that way. They really view it as a social justice system of ideas for humanity. Not necessarily that you have to actually keep the laws of kashrut, and that you have to observe the Sabbath or anything like that. These are just ideas to internalize. If you read some of the Reform scholarship out there, that seems to be how it began and developed over the years.
It's very flexible.
Super flexible.
Okay. Thank you.
Super flexible. Yes.
When, let's say, the debate about quinoa and whether or not that counts as kosher for Passover, and then there's
right.
all these debates about whether it does or not, and then some rabbi says,
right. There is kosher for Passover quinoa. Don't fret.
But the point is, it's not the Sanhedrin.
No.
But there is some rabbi who seems to have enough authority
good.
To be able to say,
okay, good.
This is now a rule, everybody should follow it.
So you see, I quote Rabbi Soloveitchik a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how did Rabbi Soloveitchik become that kind of rabbi that would say, I think the quinoa is fine, and all of a sudden thousands of Orthodox Jews are eating quinoa on Passover? Or another rabbi, Moshe Feinstein, says it's not good. And no one's eating it now. He's not a member of the Sanhedrin. So Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and the greats of every generation, by the way, they're not appointed. How do they develop their greatness?
Reputation.
Just reputation for scholarship. That's it. Scholarship and piety. Okay, and of course their personality traits. You know, they're greats in many regards. They're not members of the Sanhedrin, so they would never attempt to try to change a law. They don't have that authority. Their opinion as to the application of a modern-day situation to the existing body of Jewish literature in that area is considered authoritative because they just know more. So people come to rely on their opinions because they're more trusted. They just seem to know more. And many times, different rabbis will get different reputations in different areas. Just like in the field of law, there are people who specialize in contract law, and property law, and immigration law, or in medicine. This person is a pulmonologist, this person is a cardiologist. You'll have rabbis who are known, you know, to be experts in fertility issues, like we're going to talk a little about, on cosmetic surgery questions, on medical ethics issues. There are experts when it comes to law and law, like comparative law. I was trying to develop myself in that way when I was in law school, and so they're not appointed by anyone. It's not a dynasty either. It's not like parent-child. That's more in the Hasidic world. It's whoever develops himself into the greatest scholar. And they get to answer questions just like you would ask me a question. I'll give you my opinion. But my opinion is not as authoritative because I'm not nearly as great of a scholar as some of those other rabbis. That's all it is. It's just a question of who's on a higher spiritual / intellectual level when it comes to the halacha.
So in terms of what we're reading here about the concept of majority, does that apply in those situations, or is it something that I can actively disagree with, and because it's not rabbinic and it's not biblical, it's just an opinion of somebody who I greatly respect, but maybe I disagree, am I sort of quote-unquote free to not follow what they said? If it becomes a majority in the case.
So that's why it's a great question. That's why it says in the Ethics of Our Fathers, Aseh Lecha Rav, make for yourself a rabbi. Because you can shop around and find a rabbi who's a little leaning on this and strict on that, so I'll stay away from that thing, but I'll go to him for this. And I'll find this guy over here. It's called forum shopping. Right? You're supposed to try to be consistent as possible. You don't need to go to a lot of people. You're supposed to try to have a rabbi who can answer. Now, often, people who've made me their rabbi, I'll often say, I've got to get back to you, and I'll have to check with other rabbis for their opinion, because I may not know the answer, or I want to schmooze it out with them a little. You know, if you're asking a question, you're supposed to try to follow the answer. Unless it also...
Let's be honest, a lot of times we ask questions because we want a specific answer.
Well, it also depends on how you ask. You could elicit a rabbi's opinion. If somebody goes to Rabbi Pinney and say, I don't know. I'm just curious what you would think about this, but I'm not really asking you a question because I don't want to get stuck with the answer kind of thing. You could do that. The idea is to try to be as consistent as possible by having a person, but I'll tell you what the ideal is. What's the ideal, guys, based on everything I've said tonight?
Learn for yourself.
Ideal is to learn for yourself, to become enough of a Torah scholar so you can answer your own questions. Not that the rabbis don't want to be bothered, and there'll always be something you'll need to ask, because you're always learning, and there's always somebody greater. But that's the goal, is to develop ourselves intellectually and Jewishly. And the more we can do that, the less we have to be reliant on others. You know? And that's a good thing. We want smart, intelligent, independent Jews. We don't want simply, robotically following the leaders in the community. What should I do? What should I do? We want you to be able to form your own opinion because you have internalized enough Torah so you could really have a sense of how to handle this situation. Okay, I don't want to take it away of more of Rabbi Pinney's time. Thank you all for listening. I'm sorry I kept you guys late. Have a great night, everyone. You don't have